Hello, Bill. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks, Shane. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. I recently read your book, which is the sequel to your earlier book, which is called Confessions of a Highly Sensitive Man, was your first one, and this one's called On Being a Sensitive Man. I just wanted to make sure I got those titles correct. And these books are really aimed at exploring the landscape of what it means to be a highly sensitive person, but specifically a highly sensitive man in the sort of modern world, right, where definitions and understanding of masculinity and femininity and what those categories mean and, you know, how people use and integrate those into their lives and into their personalities, how that kind of plays out in the real world for people, you know, like yourself who, you know, are one of the highly sensitive individuals, which I think in your book you quoted were like something like up to 20% of the population, if that's correct.
That's true. Highly sensitive people are represent about 20% of the entire human population. So we're talking probably about 1.5 billion people.
It's a lot of people.
It is. It's, yeah, by number, sheer numbers, it's large. Percentage-wise, it's smaller, but it's nevertheless, it's a big number.
It's pretty significant if it's 20%. I mean, that's not a number you can just ignore, right? I mean, even things that are 1% make significant difference.
And so, absolutely. Yeah, when you're talking about the whole population of the world, yes, it is significant.
Absolutely. And so this is a great area. You know, it's not really explored much in popular culture, in sort of academia, even in psychology. You know, there is some discussion around, you know, the sort of sensitivity personality traits and what that means and how that manifests, but not such a sort of well-researched, you know, account of it. So, you know, maybe let's begin, you know, because I think like me, before having read your book, I actually didn't even know this was a thing, right? And so what does it mean to you? What is a highly sensitive person?
Well, it's a personality trait, first of all, and it's not a disorder or dysfunction of any kind. And it's relatively new in terms of sort of being on the roadmap in psychology and neuroscience as well. Dr. Elaine Aron was the person who coined the term back in the mid-90s when she wrote her book on highly sensitive persons. Which is kind of a definition that has been attached to this particular personality trait. And the personality trait is called sensory processing sensitivity. That's the scientific technical term for it. But high sensitivity became the easier one that became popularized. That's what people started adapting to identify the trait. You know, I had... the trait since I was born, of course, and it's a genetic trait. It's not something that's is necessarily learned. However, your environment does affect the trait and you because of one of the things that sensory processing sensitivity came out of in terms of is a theory. It came out of this larger theory called environmental sensitivity theory, and that basically is about how an organism interacts with its environment. And sensitivity, as we know it, is actually a spectrum. It's not just the highly sensitive people than everybody else. Everybody has a degree of this sensitivity that is used in this environmental sensitivity theory. There are some, 20% of the population or 25, somewhere around there. On the lower end are people who are probably more resilient to the environment, less impacted by it. Some people might say they're a little hardier because they're less impacted by the environment. You've got a big middle. You think of a bell-shaped curve, you got a big middle, and that's probably where the bulk of the population is. Mm-hmm. And then at the very top end is where the highly sensitive people are. And that's, again, 20%. I've heard numbers as high as 25, but let's just say 20. And these are the people that are most impacted by the environment. That's where that sensitivity comes in. You know, there's so much a kind of a pejorative assigned to the term sensitive, and especially if it's used in describing a man. But really, the sensitivity is really more about sensory interface with the environment and with the individual. And that's really where I'm coming to at this point in terms of my own personal acceptance of the term and myself being a sensitive man.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, like go ahead.
No, so I just wanted to clarify here so that, you know, it has to do with sensory processing, right? Which is how we make sense of our external and internal worlds, right? Sort of in our consciousness, right? And so what you're getting at is that people, I mean, it is quite hard to conceptualize, right? Like sensitive is a very operative word because it's sort of the degree to which sensory information, you know, directly affects you, or maybe not directly affects you, but how much of your attention it draws, maybe is a good way of putting it, right? And so the people who you say are on the lower end of the sensitivity spectrum, you know, they can interact with a large amount of sensory information at once and not be overwhelmed by it, or not have it be too interrupting of their sort of, you know, state of flow, let's say. Whereas on the higher end, people in that sort of category, you know, they take in the information and it has a much bigger impact, right? Which I guess is why sensitive is a good word, because they're sensitive to that information. It doesn't just come in and out.
Right. And that's really kind of one of the things that I and with others like myself are trying to educate people about the trait itself. Again, when people think of someone who's sensitive, they think of an overly emotional, frail, easily hurt individual without even considering the other factors that are involved, such as what we're talking about, this ability to process increased amounts of sensory information. And sometimes that does get overwhelming. It would be overwhelming for anyone if, as I like to put it, the aperture for accepting sensory information inputs from, it could be emotional inputs from the environment as well as physical.
Mm-hmm.
If your aperture is more open, you're going to receive more data, right? And if you're going to receive more data, sometimes that data can become overwhelming. And that's what happens a lot of times to highly sensitive people, is their reactions to that are that overwhelm, that overstimulation that happens when you get a lot of stuff hitting you at the same time. Right. So there's explanations for that. It's not just bad behavior or someone who has impulse issues or whatever. It is simply a matter of being able to deal with the stimulation that you're getting from the environment. Now, there are four main things, and I'm going to get these in real quick so we can use that as our foundation. What four things that are evidence-based, verifiable traits of highly sensitive people. And you can use the acronym DOES, D-O-E-S. And D stands for depth of processing. Highly sensitive people, not only do they take in a lot of sensory information, but they process it at a very deep level. A lot of times things may come into someone who is not an HSP, a highly sensitive person, and they take it to a shallow level and process. This doesn't have to do with intelligence as much as it does with the amount of, sorry, processing cycles you put through the inputs that you're getting. That can take a lot of resource out of a person as well. And you'll have to forgive me for using the computer metaphors, because my career is an information technology manager, so that's usually one of the easiest ones. Yeah.
No, it's widely applicable today.
Yeah, and today it probably makes a lot more sense. I think most people can appreciate. But that depth of processing is something that helps us to pick out information from the environment and to be able to gain insights in terms of creativity, in terms of problem solving. But it's a time-consuming process, and a lot of times that's one of the things that HSPs get caught up in, is this deep processing. The O stands for the overstimulation and the overwhelm. This happens quite a bit with highly sensitive people. And I think more than anything else, it has more to do with the fact that highly sensitive people are not really trained on how to deal with the amount of information they're getting in. They're not inherently taught about calming techniques for the mind, being able to throttle things down and know when to pull themselves out and to recharge and regenerate and get away from the processing. But overstimulation is something that highly sensitive people are very much prone to. Mm-hmm. The E stands for emotional reactivity. This is something I think that probably is one of the more outer signs that you see. This is the thing that people kind of associate with sensitivity, is that emotional reactivity. But it also means depth of emotion, too. We feel things at a much deeper level than most people do. And that does impact us as well. It means we process hurt more, or we process love greater. These are all things that highly sensitive people are wired to do mm-hmm. in processing all these emotions. That also leads to the other side of that E, which is empathy. We have a great deal of empathy for our fellow man. We are very often found in helping professions as counselors or doctors or nurses or teachers, places where we can share that empathy with the world. We all have mirror neurons. These are things that help us to mirror other people's reactions. It's sort of inherent with humans because we're social animals. But for some reason, with highly sensitive people, those mirror neurons are much more active. Mm-hmm. And so that empathy gets kind of ramped up a bit. And then finally, the last letter is for sensing the subtle, or sensory acuity is what I call it. It's about picking up nuanced pieces of sensory information. The metaphor I often use is walking into a party, the highly sensitive person will be the one who hears the music's too loud, or might smell the perfume across the room that's too much, or the hors d'oeuvres are too salty. But anyway, it's a sort of a picking up a sense of what's going on in the environment, probably at a much deeper level than most people do. So that makes us ideally suited for things like picking up issues at an intuitive level. It's actually just deep, unconscious material, or things that we've sensed and we picked up and are able to put together and make sense of. Mm-hmm. So that's the four main characteristics of highly sensitive people.
Yeah.
And if you put those in kind of a broader context, you can see that it's just not about moodiness or about being too sensitive to criticism, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole brain circuitry wiring situation, and also how we interact with the environment. All those four characteristics mm-hmm. are impacted by that.
Yeah, I think those are, you know, that's a great foundation for us. And, you know, the point that I kind of want to pick up on first maybe is this, it's the first D. I mean, it's the D, right? It's the depth of right. processing, right? Now, it's quite hard to really make sense of, or maybe it's not make sense of it because we have an intuitive understanding of when we say, you know, oh, like that's very deep, or it's very moving, or it affects us in a deep way. And we kind of know what that means practically, but to sort of conceptualize what that depth is quite hard, right? Because yes. it isn't exactly, at least as far as I'm aware, it's not exactly clear what that means to, you know, process something deeply. Like, I understand it and I do it. I'm not saying it's not a thing, but to really make sense of what's the difference between a deep processing and a sort of, I guess, surface level processing. You know, do you have any ideas on that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Shane. I mean, there isn't a lot of, I think, definitive information about particularly what that means in a kind of a way you can use it as an example. But what I guess what I would say is that very often we process in a kind of a, sometimes people would call it overthinking, but I honestly think it's just, it gets rehashed and rehashed and gets rehashed at a deep, deep level. In other words, it's like a processing cycle mm-hmm. where you're taking a bit of data, and I would say that the majority of the population would take that data, process it through, and out it would go, whereas highly sensitive people take it deeper and deeper and deeper. trying to squeeze out every bit of meaning out of everything that was said. So, for example, if someone said to me something that was hurtful, you know, I would take that on a deep dive. Why is that person thinking that way about me? Instead of letting it roll off and think about it at a very shallow level. And again, this doesn't mean that people aren't highly sensitive, can't think deeply or think in an intelligent way, because I don't think this is about intelligence. I think it's about how much the information is churned mm-hmm. inside of us. So it keeps going through and through cycles and cycles until we can kind of, you know, squeeze Resolve. Every bit of data out of that and figure out what it is. Now, sometimes that's a good thing because it may be helpful and useful in processing that sensory information that we're getting and getting the little nuggets out of it. Sometimes it's not such a good thing because maybe we're rehashing and we get into this area. A lot of, I think, highly sensitive people have a problem with this, is this rumination, going over something over and over and over again, where there is no solution, where there is no answer to it. So in both examples, I think it's just the kind of churn that highly sensitive people do with the inputs that they have. It can be a two-edged sword. It can be something that's very positive in that you get things that other people miss, but it can also be bad in that you're rehashing stuff that there's no point in rehashing anymore.
Right. And I think that double-edged sword analogy is sort of applicable to everything in life, right?
Yes, absolutely.
There's the good parts of it, and then there's the downside of it. And it makes sense what you're saying, where, you know, this deep processing is really, you know, paying attention to small pieces of information, trying to dissect and reconstruct the meaning of what this is, right? And as you say, sometimes that's an invaluable asset to have, right? Because it means you can really attend and get at the core, the essence of something. But sometimes it comes at a cost, because you're essentially putting yourself through cycles of rumination of potential, usually pain or suffering of some kind or other, right? And when it doesn't get resolved, as it sometimes doesn't with rumination, that can be a problem, because you can get stuck there, right?
Absolutely.
And I mean, there's lots of ways you can get out of that, and maybe we'll get to that a bit later, but it's interesting that it's sort of, you know, it has this multi-dimensional layer to it of, yes, it's good, but it's also not always good, right?
Yeah, you know what, this is like with anything, I think, it, as you said just a second ago, it has its challenges and it has its gifts, and I think overall, it's a gift if it's understood, which is one of the reasons why I really try to advocate that people who are recognizing themselves as highly sensitive people become as educated as possible about the trait so they understand it. I think part of the problem with a lot of highly sensitive people, because it's not well popularized and it's not something that is talked about quite a bit, they go through life thinking there's something wrong with them and that there's, you know, they don't see the bright side or the gifted side of it, and they see the bad side of it because that's all they hear. That's the mm-hmm. feedback they get. You're too sensitive, you do this too much, you do that too much, and so forth.
And it causes them a lot of suffering, right?
Exactly. Of course, that just feeds the rumination machine, and you know, they're beating themselves up because of it.
Yeah.
A lot of this has to do with, I think, we're kind of at the discovery phase, I think, now of where highly sensitive is. There's a lot of new research that's going on. They're finally doing things with functional magnetic resonance imagery, which is getting into where the brain is working when things are happening with highly sensitive people. Those kind of studies, I think, are going to add depth and dimension. And mm-hmm. what I hope that does is eventually comes out with things that, as a result, the output of that is going to be how highly sensitive people can deal with the challenging parts of being sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like if you were, let's say, a psychic. I mean, I'm using an abstract example here. You're a psychic, and you can read what people are thinking about you. Well, that may have some advantages at first, but after a while, it becomes tedious, and then there's times you don't want to hear it anymore, but you don't know how to turn it off. And so I think, similarly, highly sensitive people need to be able to have a break sometimes from the trait, And these are things that we're having to educate people about. And I think there's going to be more that comes out of the research that's going to help highly sensitive people deal with it. But more often than not, when I see people talking about the trait who have the trait, they'll very often emphasize the challenges and de-emphasize the gifts about it. So,
right.
You know, it's kind of getting into that balance. You know, you've got to recognize that one goes with the other. It's yin and yang here. And you have to deal with the challenges as well as the gifts at the same time.
And also, as you had said earlier, most of it's not really a choice, right? It's sort of a built-in biology. And so, you know, that first step, as is with many things in life, is that sort of acceptance of who you are, right? And how you work.
Exactly. You know, and I tell you what, growing up in the southeastern United States, which is a very traditional area as a male, having this trait, I was already bucking the trend, not intentionally, but that's the way I was. So I spent the greater portion of my life, because I didn't find out about the trait until I was in my mid-40s, almost 50. Mm-hmm. I was still trying to live this sort of traditional ideal, which kind of goes against, in a lot of ways, the highly sensitive trait. And I wasn't being true to myself. I wasn't being authentic. I was living a lie, basically. So the idea is that if you can embrace the trait and understand it, what will happen is you'll be able to live with it much more effectively. And you'll start learning things. I learned, on my own about meditation. I learned about neurofeedback brain training. I actually had a business doing that, hypnosis, and all kinds of techniques that I used to calm my brain down, because naturally I needed to do that. And it wasn't a matter of, gee, it would be nice to do this for combating stress. It was like I had to do it, especially in the business I was in. So you learn these things on your own, but you can never, even though I tried not to be a sensitive man, I couldn't not be who I was. I mean, it's like I said, it's in the biology of my brain, the way it's wired. So I it's difficult to walk away from that.
Yeah. And when you're going against who you are, I mean, you feel it and you suffer it, you know,
absolutely.
You might be able to, I don't know if this is too strong of a word, but you might be able to delude yourself for a while, but it doesn't last, right? Because at the end of the day, when you close your eyes, it's just you, right? And you know what feels right and what doesn't for you. And it's interesting what you say, because it's true. It's like only once you know where you are and what things mean, can you start to do something about it, right? You need to have that foundation. And it's great that, you know, people like you and others who are sort of speaking about this topic, so that other people might be able to say, oh, maybe that's me, right? Maybe this is why I've felt so different or alienated or wrong or whatever those feelings that might come or thoughts that might come up about yourself are. And, you know, for someone like you to come along and say, no, you know, this is actually a normal thing. Like it's a biological trait, just like, I don't know, the level of your aggression or, you know, how, I don't know, your facial structures. You know, you can sort of analogize it in any way you want, but the point of it is it's like, well, no, but this is how you are. I mean, and it will manifest idiosyncratically for each individual, of course, and so it's not exactly the same for everyone, but, you know, these are good patterns to look at and take that and say, okay, well, what do I do with this, right? How do I maximize or capitalize on the strengths of it where I can and want to? And how do I decrease the limitations or deal with the negative aspects of it, right? And, you know, there's many ways to do that. You know, proper affect regulation, you know, mental regulation, things that most people don't really know how to do anyway, but are particularly bad for, you know, a highly sensitive person who is overly overwhelmed by it, right? It's not as like something you can just deal with or you know, step aside, right?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, and you know, what's interesting is that what you, a lot of this journey for you is the movement towards, not movement, maybe that's the wrong word, but, you know, your focus is around men, right? Because there's an interesting phenomenon that's happening in our society at the moment, Western society, I don't really know about others, but where, you know, gender roles and sexuality and all these kinds of, and different sort of gender identity things are coming up. And, you know, it's an interesting and important area to explore. And one of those areas is the idea of masculinity, right? Yes. And what does it mean to be a man that you can be, you know, proud of and have respect for, both from yourself, mostly from yourself, but also potentially from other people, such that, you know, you're fulfilling that role to the fullest potential that you can. And what does that look like? And it's not all that clear anymore, right? Because the world's very different now.
Absolutely. That's a really important thing. I when I started writing the books and before that writing the blogs, I had really wasn't thinking in those terms, that the term masculinity is what's kind of defined my life and a lot of men's lives. And that I didn't fit into that model very easily. As I started to write more about it, I started to realize that, you know, very few men really do fit into that model. In fact, one of the things that we're finding, research is blossoming everywhere about this, about the difficulties that men have in trying to live up to this standard of masculinity that the West has cultivated. And frankly, it's all over the world. It really isn't just a Western thing. It became kind of a sub cause for me. First was to try to reach out to highly sensitive men. But secondly is to reach men generally and realizing that I think it's time that we really did review what we have created in terms of masculinity, because frankly, masculinity is more of a cultural construct than anything else. It's something that you're taught, you're socialized in when you're very young. Every boy and every man has this man code that we have to live up to. And part of it is in creating this idealized version of what men are supposed to be as stoic warriors, unemotional, totally logical, never needing help, never being vulnerable. And it doesn't work. In fact, it's literally killing men. Mm-hmm. You know, the rates of suicide in men is continuing to climb. I'm not saying it's off the charts yet, but it's still quite alarming that so many men give up because they don't think they can ask for help. They don't think that they can be vulnerable. And part of that is suppressing those parts of what I consider to be human attributes, being able to express emotion, being able to feel emotion. I just read an article yesterday, and I posted it yesterday, about men having more difficulty after a breakup of a relationship than women do. And one of the reasons why is because men don't have outlets for expressing these very complex relationship and emotional issues that come up as a result of a breakup in a relationship. And very often it leads to despair, depression, and in some cases, aggressive behavior, which is a much more acceptable masculine activity than it is to be vulnerable and to share your emotions and look for help. So, yeah, I think this is the time, especially now in the history of mankind. I think the generations that are younger than I am are much more in tune with this and much more open to this idea of looking at masculinity based on just the things you talked about, whether people are redefining what gender means, what sexuality means to them, and also, more importantly, roles. You know, men and women aren't doing the same thing they did 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an evolution, a positive evolution, but we don't have an updated version of masculinity to match up with that. In the 60s and 70s, there was the women's movement that helped build a platform for women to have more equal positions in society, which they most richly deserve. But there wasn't really a corresponding men's movement. There were attempted things at trying to get men together to do that. I know there were a lot of people that were working on that, but I don't think there was a kind of a corresponding collective for updating what masculine means. And I think this is the time and this is the place for it to probably start rolling out, because it is affecting not only men, but boys and women and, you know, everybody on the planet, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, right? Because the more I think about the world we live in today, and, you know, I have a very obviously limited perspective on things. And, you know, I'm only sort of, 28? And so I'm I guess, what you would consider part of that younger generation of sort of trying to figure it out. But the more things become global, let's say, with the technological revolution, right? The more the more perspective you get on how things work in different places, right? And I'm not so sure that we can have a sort of singular masculine or feminine archetype that is even somewhat applicable to each individual instance or even a general group, because things are changing so rapidly that this is, you know, a new playing field. It's unprecedented what is currently happening. And there's a lot of good that's happening, and there's a lot of not such good things that are happening. And, you know, there's debates equally worthy on both sides, and that's fine. And that's part of the evolution, is to figure out what works and what doesn't, and, you know, focus on what works and sort of build and develop on that, right? And so it's not a bad thing that all these things are sort of coming up and are confusing, but living in the world during this time can be very confusing, right? Mm-hmm. And difficult. And, you know, I don't want to say it's more difficult for one, you know, gender or another, because it's very difficult to quantify that. It's very specific, right? On an individual basis. Whatever, people can have their views. I mean, that's fine. And maybe I'm wrong. I'm not trying to, you know, say, preach anything. But so, you know, like, my point was that, you know, what does it mean to be a man today? That question to me is probably best characterized as, what does it mean to be the best version of yourself? Right? I think that's the best way of an individual thinking about it, because that's really the best you can get, as opposed to trying to match or embody or, you know, sort of be this idealized version that a society has sort of created for you or for anyone else, which is really difficult and potentially impossible, especially if it's archetypal, right? Because archetypes exist outside of reality in the sense of, like, you can't be an archetype exactly. That's why they're archetypes, right? They're extractions from the pattern. And so, you know, it's a complicated question to which there aren't exact answers, other than perhaps figure out what the best version of you is and aim for that, right?
You know what? I absolutely love that. I really do. In fact, I kind of wrote about some of that in the books, where instead of saying, let's be the ideal male or be the ideal female, let's be more human, right? The human characters, be a good human being first, then you worry about whether or not you're matching up to what your gender is supposed to be or not. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's becoming more and more fluid. And I think people, by saying there's two boxes you can be in, really goes against what you're saying there, but, you know, where you can be the best person you are. Because what if you don't fit in the box? Mm-hmm. You need to be able to be who you are. And I agree with you 100%. Be your best self first. These boxes are limiting. Part of the reason I even suggest, let's look at masculinity and open up the hood, so to speak, and look at it, is to make it more inclusive. Mm-hmm. What goes in that box, I don't know, but it just needs to be more inclusive. There are going to be people that are going to stick with those traditional values in some way, shape, or form.
Sure.
But I agree with you 100%, Shane. I really think we should all be who we are first, mm-hmm. and that is be human beings and be our maximum potential human self, which embodies all your personality characteristics and your traits and your tendencies and so forth and so on. If you want to be happy, that's what you need to be.
Right. And it's also, you know, putting the human first is central, because it highlights, you know, the sovereignty of the individual, which is something that is foundational to at least our cultures, you know, Western primarily cultures, mm-hmm. I suppose, and that it is not about a matter of which labels you can tick off for yourself. Right now, I'm not saying those things aren't real. Of course they are. And, you know, we're sort of built to categorize things to make processing the world easier. Right. And so we do categorize people and events and situations to make sense of them. And then, right. you know, with higher order thinking, we get to challenge them and evolve, and with new information, you know, change how that looks for us and therefore change our outlook on reality as a whole. But also, you know, if you think about it, I mean, how could you possibly come up with one answer that clearly defines the role of, let's say, 3.5 billion people into one category, like male, let's say, right? You take roughly half the population of the earth. And now you're going to say, oh, well, 3.5 billion people, which is actually, it's like an uncomprehendable number for, you know, like in real terms, how many people that is.
Right.
And to suggest that, you know, it's going to be, you know, uniform throughout, it's probably a way too big of a generalization. But I do think it's important to address, you know, sort of at a more ground level, let's say, because we are inclined to be like, well, what does it mean to be, you know, a man? What does it mean to be a parent? What does it mean to be, you know, a leader or a servant, or, you know, a civil servant, or a, you know, a follower of this, or a believer in this? It's like we do, you know, work with ourselves to figure out what that exactly means for us. And so it's not an invalid, I mean, it's a very important line of thought, because you can't just do away with it and expect it to just disappear, right? They're very instinctual urges that we have to figure out who we are and exactly. how we fit in a society that is filled with categories, right? And where we belong to each one, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the changes that'll take place are going to probably be intergenerational changes.
Sure.
It's not something that's going to happen in 5 years. Or when things happen like this, especially as you were mentioned, we're a global society now. Information is exchanged so easily between cultures. And I've been really finding that out since I've written the book and had a chance to talk to people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I found out is that we share more than we differ on. I was really surprised how easily it was to be able to share at the level I've been doing with people across cultures. But this is going to take some time. And anything that happens like that is going to be more organic than it is to be, say, okay, well, let's have a big convention in Switzerland next year, and we'll have all, you know, some of the top men in the world get together, and we'll sit down and define what masculinity should look like and then come back out and sort of socialize that. That's probably not going to be the way it's going to happen. It's going to happen in a much more organic level. It's already happening as we talk. I mean, There's a gradual shifts that are taking place. It's like tectonic plate theory. The crust is always moving. You just don't perceive it all the time. And I think it's already happening, as I said, as we speak. I think it's happening at the speed with which I guess it needs to happen. This is going to be a change that's going to has to be assimilated as well. So it's going to be something that's going to take some time. But I think the good thing is that we can talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We can bring it up. We can discuss it. We can pro and con it and all, and everything that we want to normally do is analytical creatures, but the idea is that the shift is already taking place. It's got to, because our society demands it. The institutions that we have, the things that we require of people now, the roles they have to play in order to be, in order to live and exist. So it's happening. Mm-hmm. How it happens, you know, I probably won't live to see the fruit of this discussion, where it will go someday, but I certainly hope that my grandson and granddaughters can see that.
Yeah.
And that it's going to be positive for them.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I think you're right. The grassroots level is where it really integrates into a culture. You know, a top-down approach of like dictating what things are very rarely works for these kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. It works for law and order and things like that. But even there, there's, you know, regulatory bodies and there's checks and balances that happen at every level to make sure it's all good, right? And that it matches the current situation and that it changes when and where needed. But the grassroots or the organic approach certainly is a much greater influence on things. But it's a trying time for many people. And, you know, I can sort of speak to the experience of some young men, let's say, from my own perspective, where it's like, it's hard because, you know, being conditioned by a culture of which I've had influence from many, because, you know, I was born in South Africa, I come from a Jewish family, then I moved to Canada, and the sort of, you know, melting pot of cultures that exist here, and with online access now, it's access to the world. And I've been very fortunate to be able to get to talk to people in this podcast from all over the world, right? And explore that. And so it's really been fantastic. But at the same time, you know, we do look for direction. I think that's people in general, not specifically men. We want direction, and the uncertainty that sort of pervades this realm at the moment is very unsettling, because you don't know where to go, and you don't know how to know where to go, right? I think that's a big challenge, right?
Yeah, it is. You know, again, there are a lot of people, I think, that are caught up in sort of what the traditional roles are and have been. And there's always going to be a fight to keep things the way they've always been. And so it can be very difficult to navigate. And even at my age, I see things that are out there and I feel like I'm swimming against the stream. I'm like a salmon going upstream. I'm fighting the current sometimes. But the thing that gives me the hope, I think, is that there is a sense, and this is why, kind of to sort of tie this all together in a bow, highly sensitive people, by and large, I think, are usually the first ones to see things like this coming, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're sensing things at a much deeper level, and they're also paying attention to things like this because they have greater impact on highly sensitive people. One of the things that I was hoping to be able to do is to help more highly sensitive men particularly stand up and become aware of the trait and embrace it, and use that as a platform to go forward and share with other men about being more emotionally aware, being more able to express themselves in different ways that are non-traditional male ways, mm-hmm. To help model what it could look like for men to be more open that way. And I think that this would be a good time for highly sensitive men to do that. Now, one of the things that Dr. Aaron speaks of, which I kind of latched onto, was this idea that highly sensitive people have an evolutionary purpose, right, for the population at large. In many ways, we're kind of the canary in the coal mine. Sometimes she refers to it as sort of a priestly advisor role that nature has baked in to help preserve the larger population. People that are aware of things, people that are able to process this information and come to some new conclusions and some new ideas, sort of that creative aspect mm-hmm. of high sensitivity, and to be able to propagate that amongst the other population. So I think, like I said, the idea of trying to get highly sensitive people to become aware of the trait, to embrace it, and then to embrace this evolutionary quality that the trait has. You know, if nature had baked this in and it was not useful, and you, if you looked at it on the surface, you might think, well, what good could sensitive people be if they're really, you know, having all these difficulties processing things? We would have been selected out millennia ago, you mm-hmm. know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, but we weren't, and we continue to survive, and we continue to be here. And I really believe that's because in the kind of cosmic intelligence of which nature is a part of, there is some reason that high sensitive people are baked in. And it's not just humans. I mean, there's over 100 animal species where they've been able to trace the same kind of attributes and traits within it. So it is sort of a natural thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the evolutionary quality of it is that this is a good time, especially now, our not country, but the world is at a crossroads in a lot of things, anywhere yeah. from climate change to wealth inequality to, you know, our pandemic is an example of what is going on that could be a call to arms that we need to pay attention to what's going on to our planet. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where highly sensitive people can really have a big role.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, is that, you know, variation is essential to evolution, right? Mm-hmm. What's it called? When it's the same across the board, then everyone's susceptible to one thing that can wipe out everything. Right.
Exactly.
And yeah. you only have one perspective or one approach. You don't get to incorporate different elements from different perspectives and different understandings and different ways of seeing the world. And so I completely agree that from an evolutionary perspective, it's probably reasonable to conclude that, like, well, the highly sensitive trait exists for a reason, right? And perhaps we don't know that reason entirely, and maybe we never will. Maybe it's beyond our sort of human comprehension level, but we can certainly explore it and understand it and see what the best way to utilize it is, right? For individuals, I like to think more on an individual scale, perhaps, than a sort of global one, because I'm like, it's too complicated to understand for me. So for me, it's like, yeah. You know, let's figure out how you can use your talents and your natural abilities to the best way possible. And the other point I just wanted to make quickly about what we were talking about earlier is that, you know, I don't think that we're saying that highly sensitive males is the future or is in any way better than those who aren't, right? We're saying that there's just a difference. And it's good to acknowledge that difference because it's important, because it affects, you know, individuals differently. And so that's okay for that to be the case. And nor are we saying that we must get rid of entirely the function of gender roles or of, you know, many of the elements of, you know, gender roles that exist and that are, you know, to a large degree, very useful. And
absolutely,
and good, right?
Yes.
We should figure out the ones that aren't, and sort of do away with those, or that aren't useful anymore. Perhaps at one time they certainly were, and then, you know, sort of craft it from that way, right?
I think that's perfectly put. I like to use a sort of the metaphor that masculinity could be femininity, whatever. Is like a coat, right, that an actor wears. It's a costume that we put on, and men put on, and they wear that. But just like any costume, it can be taken off, it could be redesigned, it could be retailored, and it could be adapted to whatever is necessary for that particular time.
Right.
And I think that's really what I think, at least that's what I'm seeing, is that there are aspects of we call traditional masculinity, they're actually good. And a lot of men are very comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it needs to reflect our culture. It needs to reflect our times. And I don't think it does right now. And as you said earlier, too, no way am I saying highly sensitive people are better, sharper, smarter, more intelligent, anything than anybody else. What I'm saying is they are different, and that's pretty factual. They are different in the way they process things. But that difference is a usefulness
mm-hmm.
that that can be used by everyone. Being able to detect and to be able to infer things from the environment that simply because we don't have any choice but to pay attention to it, could be very useful at some point down the road. So and it doesn't have to be figuring out whether it's there's a saber-toothed tiger behind a tree or something. It could be more about the direction we're taking as a culture, maybe lethal or toxic, and having that inference and that understanding that that's a bad thing, and to be able to advise, especially people in leadership roles, about that would be what I consider the ideal function for a highly sensitive person.
Right. And it's a good point because, you know, what you want in a leadership team, whether you're looking at a low level leadership team or a high level executive leadership team of like a government, let's say, right, is you want people who have different strengths. You don't want all of the same people. That's not how you Right. function most successfully. You want people who know different things so that you can, you know, coagulate all of those things together to sort of create, you know, an even better version that is a consequence of all the parts being put together, right? And they're different parts, not different as in better or worse, but different, and different is good and it's fine. And by doing that and knowing, you know, each of us knowing, let's say, what our role is and where we play into our strengths and where we let others play into their strengths, where that might be our weakness and vice versa and so forth, that's a good thing, right? That's proper teamwork in the sense of like maximizing the most possible available resources, right?
Exactly.
And it's about figuring out what's best for you as an individual. And, you know, so you're right. And in your book, you went into how, you know, the highly sensitive person tends to be more inclined towards the sort of priestly advisor role, right? Of, you know, deep contemplation and reflection and creativity, sort of combining those elements together to Right. advise or to, you know, kind of work in that capacity, as opposed to being the sort of the explorer, which is a different kind of personality, right?
Absolutely.
And both are needed, because they protect each other and they work well together. But it's good to know who you are, and where you'll be happiest is in what works best for you, right? It's you might try the other one and find out you don't like it, and that's fine. Sometimes you have to try to know that it's not for you. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's so important, right? And so, you know, just to sort of like tie things off here, what do you suggest for people who are listening to this who might say, I think I might be a highly sensitive person and, you know, I want to know more about it. You know, what's the best way to approach this?
Well, actually, there's really only one test that's valid and reliable to measure high sensitivity, and it's Elaine Aaron's questionnaire that she has on her website, hsperson.com. It's a self-test. It takes probably 10 minutes at most. You're probably 20, 30 questions, and you self-grade it. And it pretty much will get you in the ballpark and let you know whether or not you are highly sensitive. Now, there isn't anything that measures gradation, like if you're very high in the highly sensitive category or very low, but it will get you into that. That's like I said, into the ballpark and let you know that you're highly sensitive by most measurements that she has on the test. So that would be the first thing. And once you find that you are, and even if you don't score high enough to be considered a highly sensitive person, you might be at right at the cusp. I would be educated more, if especially if it interests you.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of good material on her site. I've got tons of blogs that I've written on thesensitiveman.com. That's my website. More and more, even if you just Google highly sensitive men or highly sensitive people, highly sensitive persons, you're going to have a lot of websites coming up. There's lots of information coming online every day mm-hmm. about the trait. So I would just say that they need to educate themselves to understand the trait, which will help them understand themselves, especially if they're highly sensitive.
And I'm sure there's groups too, right?
Yeah. There's a whole lot of Facebook groups, if that's your thing. There are some groups that are forming around highly sensitive men. This has been kind of a conundrum, the highly sensitive men side. When you see groups that, like on Facebook and other places, tendency is that there's a larger representation of women than there are men. And one of the biggest problems is getting men to acknowledge that they are sensitive. They have this trait. And so a lot of men are resistant to accepting it. I know I was.
Mm-hmm.
And so the representation, even though the population split 50-50 in terms of highly sensitive people, a lot of men just are really struggling embracing the idea. And I think it's really to their detriment, because they really should learn about the trait, even if they're doing it privately without mm-hmm. acknowledging it publicly. But the idea is that the more they learn about it, the more they realize that it's not something they should run from or hide from. It's something that they should be proud of. It is a gift, but like I said earlier, it has challenges too, and they need to be able to know how to deal with those challenges.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right, and I think it also brings us back to this idea of it being a spectrum trait, right? Where, you know, I took that test at hspersons.com, and I'll put the links in the description for anyone who's interested. And I was kind of on the cusp, on the lower end of the... I don't think I made the exact... I think the measure was like 14 and I was like 12 or something like that.
Right.
But that doesn't... It didn't really matter, because for me, it was learning about that... It was learning that, okay, I have some of these traits, let's say. Maybe I don't match the criteria to, you know, have the label. But so what, right? Because these are a part of my personality, and it's interesting and worthwhile for me to investigate those aspects. And, you know, I think that that's the spectrum of it, is it's like, okay, I'm on the much lower end of the highly sensitive. I mean, I'm on the low end of the high end of the, you know, spectrum of sensitivity, right, let's say. And so, you know, even if you don't necessarily meet the criteria of this particular test, that doesn't mean... It doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to be relevant to you. And I think perhaps the key indicator, at least that I've found, is if it's interesting to you and something sort of compels you to look into it more, that's a good sign to do that, right? Because
Absolutely.
It means something within you connects with that and wants to explore it further. And that's a, I mean, what more do you need? And you can always stop, right? And it doesn't have to be a public show. It's not, you're not, I mean, maybe it is for some people who have, you know, very public personas, and okay, fair enough. But for most people, it'll just be a sort of an inward journey. But finding people who are, you know, have similarities in this area can be very helpful and liberating to know that you're not the only one. You're not weird or different, or okay, you are different, but different in a potentially good way, and that there's lots of people like you still, right? It's not that you're so different and isolated. And yeah, I think it's an amazing, you know, area of potential growth for many people. And both of your books, you know, people can read those. It's a great way to get started. I think, you know, you present a lot of the arguments very coherently. You reference a huge amount of research, and you know, a lot of it's your own experience, which is invaluable as well, because it's difficult to separate that from, you know, the sort of scientific facts of it. But that's okay, because I think that people respond to that any better anyway. But so, yeah, so, you know, where can people find you? Do you have a website? I'll put links to it in the description, but, you know, please, you know, plug all that you would like.
Absolutely. My website is called thesensitiveman.com. I'm on Facebook as The Sensitive Man. I'm on Twitter as The Sensitive MA1. I couldn't get The Sensitive Man. But I'm also on LinkedIn and also on Instagram. So go to the website. That's where you can connect to me. I'd love to hear from people. If you have questions, I'd love to connect with you and see if I can answer some of the questions you may have. But yeah, that's usually the best way to get me is through the website.
Great. Well, listen, thank you very much, Bill, for coming on. It's been a pleasure of a discussion, and I've learned a lot. And, you know, I look forward to more of these kind of conversations. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Shane. It's been a pleasure.
All right. We'll speak soon. Take care.